Yeah, so thanks for having me here. yes, Lucien already said this. What I'm going to talk about today is has to be seen in a program that that I've been working on for some time. I'll come to that later. The title of my talk is Abstract Quantum Theory. In some sense, this is a particular attempt at understanding what is the essence of quantum theory. Okay, so of course, many people have opinions about what's the essence of quantum theory or could be. I want to focus here only on a particular perspective on this. So in particular, I want to take very serious the fact that in quantum theory, as we know it, the notion of measurement plays a very special role. And so taking that seriously for me means that I want to pursue an operational approach where this notion of measurement, of observation, is a central ingredient. And it turns out that that pursuing this direction, it seems that there does emerge a notion of abstract quantum theory. That is, what is quantum theory if we take away all kinds of other structure that we usually deal with in physical theories? So in particular, take away notions of space and time. Some people might think, well, quantum theory, if I just take the minimum, I have a Hilbert space and observe it. So this is not it, because this formulation of quantum theory that I shall refer to as a standard formulation does already presume a notion of time. Okay? So what I really want to look for here is a notion of quantum theory where we don't have space, but also we don't have time. And it seems that there does emerge such a notion from work that comes together from different directions, as Lucien already alluded to. So one stream of development comes from quantum field theory here. This goes back to very early ideas of Dirac, the generalized transformation function. And in fact, it was Raphael that first alerted me to this reference of this work of Dirac, where he was thinking about generalizing the notion of transition amplitude to space-time regions. And then Feynman's work on the path integral very much advanced this point of view. And there's this led in the 1980s to a new perspective on quantum field theory and on axiomatizing quantum field theory, known as topological quantum field theory, or more recently also as functorial quantum field theory. So this is one stream of developments that goes into this, and this turns out to converge with a different stream that comes properly from the foundations of quantum theory. In particular, one important ingredient is the convex operational framework, more recently also known as generalized probabilistic theories. Then the basic notions that you have in the foundations, and more specifically in quantum information theory, namely notion of quantum operation, notions of channels, and also more specific approaches to the foundation of quantum theory play into this, in particular work by Lucien Hardy, like the causaloid framework, formalism locality, other works like the process matrix, recent timeless approach, also categorical approaches to quantum theory. I've been working on trying to bring these things together, and started basically in 2003, with what I call the general boundary formulation, mostly based on this first part of coming from quantum field theory, and more recently bringing this really together with the other side from the foundation of quantum theory. Okay, so as I said, I want to put forward very much an operational perspective on this. And on the one hand, one can approach this by asking, well, if we look at the structure of quantum theory as we know it, can we abstract from there to get a kind of core structure? But this is not the way I want to pursue it today, but the way I want to pursue it today is different, is constructive. I want to start from basic ideas of measurement and operationalism, and it turns out, remarkably, that this leads me to the same point and converges with a different approach that starts from taking quantum theory as we know it and trying to abstract it, and links up with all these things that I put here. So please feel free to interrupt me if there's something that bothers you about what I'm saying or you want some clarification. Okay, so we start with the idea that a notion of measurement or experiment, observation, preparation, or intervention, that these are should be captured in a fundamental notion in this framework. And I will subsume this with the word process here, which has been used in the foundation's community to some extent already. So process here is an instant, basically, of an experiment or measurement observation. Also includes notions of preparation and intervention. The one important aspect of this is that processes have outcomes. Okay, so the outcomes are something that an experimenter could observe, although the experimenter doesn't really play a very important role here. So what plays an important role is the outcome. So pictorially, I will represent processes as boxes like this. Now, of course, if you do an experiment, now it works. Okay, so if you do an experiment or make some observation, it's not something that's isolated, but it's correlated with other experiments or other observations you make, or with other preparations that you make. So we cannot. Instead of talking about isolated outcomes, what we're really interested in and want to predict is correlations between, say, different outcomes here and the settings that we make on the experiments. taking this more seriously, of course, if we consider a given set of processes like here, then generically, the outcomes and their correlations will depend on a large number of other processes that happen elsewhere, right? So the first, in order to get a handle on this situation, we introduce a notion of what I shall call a boundary condition. So a boundary condition here can be thought of as subsuming the influence or the interaction with all the other processes that are around the processes that interest us. Now, to model more specifically the correlations or interactions between the different processes, I introduce a notion of what I shall call interface here. So an interface is a connection between processes, and so the idea is that this encodes the communication or signal exchanged between processes, between the processes where this interface ends. And I'll depict this as a link in these diagrams. Now to make this a bit more specific, we need to talk about that there are really different types of processes and different types of interfaces. And I'll just, to represent this here, I will just introduce some labels. So these M1, M2, M3 are the types of processes that we have here, and these sigmas are the types of interfaces that connect them in this case here. And we could also think of this boundary condition, for example, as another process, but it's a process of a special kind. I'll write X here. Now to move to a more precise notion of what I mean by measurements and observation, I introduce another notion, which is that of probe. So associated to each process of a given type, there's a space of probes. So what does that mean? What is a probe? So a probe basically provides a finer description of a process. So the word process, in fact, is a bit vague in this talk. The more precise concept here will be that of probe. So what does a probe mean? So intuitively speaking, it means that I specify experimental outcomes and or specify apparatus settings. Okay. I hope in the next slide this will be a bit more clear when I give a concrete example. Then there's a particular probe for each process type, which I call the null probe. One way to think about this is that you don't put any apparatus there, and you don't observe anything, okay? And this is represented by this null probe, okay? So I hope this will become a little bit clearer now. One thing that happens with these probes is that the probes form hierarchies of generality, okay, which then we can take to induce a partial order on this space of probes. Okay, let me make this more concrete. So say we have an apparatus that just has one light on it, and this light, when the experiment is finished, shows either red or green. Okay, that's the experiment, the apparatus. And then, so we associated with this kind of apparatus three different probes now, okay? So one probe represents the apparatus with the outcome red, one with the outcome green, and we also introduce a probe that represents the apparatus with an unspecified outcome. So physically, you can think of this as meaning that the apparatus sits there, but you don't look what the color that it chose. You just don't care. This situation is more general than either this or this one, okay? Because these are both special cases of this more general case. And this is what I mean with these hierarchies of generality. Of course, if you have more than one light or more complicated instruments, then these hierarchies will be more complex. Okay. So as I said, we use this to induce a partial order on the space of probes. So in this case here, this partial order would say the probe associated with this situation is larger or equal than the one associated with this one, and also larger or equal one than this one. Okay? While there isn't any order relation between those two. Now, the space of boundary conditions also form hierarchies. The boundary conditions also form hierarchies. One kind of intuitive example is to think of a boundary condition that specifies a temperature, okay, or temperature range. So for example, here, let's say this represents a temperature range between 10 and 15 degrees Celsius, and this between 15 and 20, and this between 10 and 20. And of course, the situation that the temperatures in this range is more general than having it in this range or in this range. And again, we encode this as a partial order on the space of boundary conditions. There's a small, well, okay, doesn't matter. of course, it's not Well, it's not necessarily clear when you refer to a process and another process, where do you draw the boundary between one process and another? And in some sense, you don't have to do that. You can, if you have two processes, then you can think of them as just being one combined process. I mean, if you have two measurement apparatuses, let's say, then you can think of the two together, or again, as a more complicated measurement apparatus. Okay, so you have a notion of composition of processes. So MN are the process types here. Then I denote the process type for the composite process by M union N. And this, of course, induces a corresponding composition of these probes. Okay, so and in that case, I will denote the composite with this little diamond symbol here. Okay. Now, say we have two processes, and then we associate with the interface between these processes a space of boundary conditions. So basically, what I'm doing here is that this notion of boundary condition I have here applies equally to the signals that are mediating the interaction between two processes, as well as to conditions on the exterior, like here. Okay, so here we have open ends of these interfaces, and in that sense, this notion of boundary condition here is just the same that appears when we connect two processes. So that means that for each type of interface, we have an associated space of boundary conditions. Now, we can combine the interfaces. So if we have two processes and a number of interfaces that connect them, then we can replace them by a single interface that's a composite interface. And this associated with that, we have a map from the product space of the boundary conditions to the space of boundary conditions of the composite here. Another notational detail. So if you take a process and you have several interfaces that end on this or connect to this process, and you put them all together in a single interface, then this is for process type M, I call this interface type DM, okay? Like boundary off, if you want. So far everything seemed to be very qualitative, and so of course, when we want to do really physics, then we have to talk about numbers or probabilities that we can measure and that we can predict. So this comes in through the notion of value, and basically what this is that if we have a given process type and a probe there, and we fix a boundary condition. Okay, so here I'm using the space of boundary conditions that's the joint space for this type of process. Then we associate it with this pair of probe and boundary condition a value. So this value is a real number in general, because we take the tradition of theoretical physics that basically says that anything that you can measure as a real number or a number of real numbers, right? So that's why we take real numbers, and that means formally that we get a pairing between the space of probes and the space of boundary conditions to the real numbers. Now, so of course, these values are supposed to lead us to probabilities or to expectation values of certain measurable quantities. So what is the meaning of these values here? So the meaning of these values is not directly that of something that you can measure, but it has the meaning of what I call here a compatibility. So it's supposed to measure the compatibility between an apparatus that I'm placing and a boundary condition, so encoded by this probe, and a boundary condition that I put outside. Okay. So this compatibility is a non-negative real number. Zero would mean it's incompatible. That means that it cannot happen that we have this apparatus with this outcome and that boundary condition. That just cannot happen. That would be zero. Okay. So before explaining a bit more what these values are and how they lead to measurable quantities, let me first remark that this pairing means that these spaces, so that means that we can think of a probe as a map from the space of boundary conditions to the real numbers, and similarly of a boundary condition as a map from the space of probes to the real numbers. Okay. That means that we inherit a lot of structure now from the real numbers. Okay. In particular, if you have two functions with real values, you can say one function is larger or equal to another function if it's larger or equal at each point, right? And it turns out that with the notion of a hierarchy of generality that I've talked about, the partial order we get there precisely coincides with the partial order of functions. Okay, that means a probe smaller or equal than another one, if the value associated with a probe is smaller or equal than the other one for any possible boundary condition. Okay. And similarly for the hierarchy of boundary conditions. Okay? Because, so again, what we're measuring is compatibility. So, for example, a given boundary condition is always at least as compatible. So if we go back to this picture. So a given boundary condition is at least as compatible with this situation than with this, right? And that's exactly why, and similarly with this one here. So that's why this partial order that I was talking about here is precisely the partial order that we have on the right-hand side between compatibilities.
I don't quite understand the role of the compatibility here and how it could introduce where does it come from?
So what we want is we want to move towards measurable quantities. And so you can think of this as some kind of proto-probability, some kind of given a boundary condition, how likely it is that you find the outcome that you specified. Okay? It should be clearer in the next slide. Okay.
Is this compatibility condition just an axiom that you impose on this bracket, or?
This is an interpretation of what this is supposed to mean.
You had a partial order earlier.
Yes.
Whatever they were called, P and D or something. And then you're saying that this gives a partial order here. So is compatibility the demand that those partial orders should be consistent?
Yes.
Or is it
demand yes.
that they should be equal? In other words, should you be able to deduce the earlier partial order
yes.
fully from this partial order?
Yeah, that's true. Yes, that's correct.
The second one.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, okay, so sometimes I introduce the other one first, and then this one, and then note that they are the same. So here I did it the other way around. But of course, I mean, if I say this notion of compatibility, it's a little bit vague to use that word, right? I mean, what does it exactly mean? And as I said already, in fact, this quantity itself isn't necessarily something that you can measure. But maybe on the next slide this will become clearer, because now let's talk about measurements, okay, and about probabilities here. So if we want to talk about a measurement, we need at least two probes to express a probability, for example. One is that you could call a non-selective probe, which means that this probe basically encodes the fact that your apparatus is sitting there, that your apparatus already will change the physics by its mere presence, right? And a second probe encodes the apparatus together with a specific outcome. So in the example I was talking about earlier, sorry, this one here, this would be an example of a non-selective probe and this a selective one. Okay, and then, so as I said, this pairing, this value, quantifies a compatibility. So in this case of the non-selective probe, it quantifies the compatibility of the boundary condition with the presence of the apparatus. In the second case, it quantifies the compatibility of the boundary condition with the presence of the apparatus, with additionally the showing the selected outcome. Okay, so this is this probe is more special than this one, and we already saw that this means that we have a partial order, and in particular, this means that the quotient. Okay, so here it is. So the quotient of those two, sorry, I used different names here. So what was P and Q here is now P star and P of G. Sorry about this. So here we have this example again with the apparatus that shows a single light. And so now the quotient of these compatibilities is a probability. So it's, as I said, you can read this as compatibility of boundary condition with apparatus, and this is compatibility of boundary condition with apparatus and outcome. Okay. And yeah, so you have this partial order, and then of course this implies that this pi here is smaller or equal to 1 if it's defined. I mean, it could happen, for example, that the denominator 0, which would signify that the apparatus isn't compatible with the boundary condition. Okay. So that this, you cannot set up this experiment, basically. That's what this would mean. Yeah.
I thought I should wait to ask this question, but I think now I shouldn't wait anymore.
Okay.
I see the apparatus, I see the ambient conditions, maybe communication between, but where is the quantum object that the apparatus is looking at? Is it just hidden inside the apparatus, or is it, I mean, it's just taken for granted, it's implicit in the whole story, or?
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's no particular notion of object that we're looking at here. We are, so the idea is very much that we're describing the act of doing measurements and of correlating measurements. We'll never explicitly talk about an object that we're measuring here. I mean, I know that you might not like this.
Well, I don't quite understand this.
I would ask the same question if you went into the boundary.
In your framework, for example, you can have these, it looks a lot like this, but you have these wires are more, they transmit systems or something like that. So at least there's somewhere where the system enters, although I agree it's kind of hidden away, but at least it's there. I don't even see here where the system
enters. Yeah, we'll come to this later in some sense. So maybe at later in this talk, because I will show that all this recovers standard quantum theory if you add the corresponding ingredients. Yeah.
You're looking at these measurements more generally, kind of the general formulation. I was just curious, so measurements are one example, but what's a more general thing than a measurement that you're looking at? I mean, that this somehow gives you a...
Yeah, what do you mean by more general?
I just mean physically, what is more, I mean, measurements are some subset of this this class of probes, but what are non-measurement probes, for example, that you are interested in?
Yeah, I mean, for example, this null probe, or there are other probes that, well, you're referring to a situation where you don't look at any outcome of some experiment.
What you're saying, measurements are one example of this broader classification of probes.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
I'm just curious, what are the non-measurement probes that you're...
Yeah, for example, okay. So, for example, you could, if you look at this picture, for example, this could be an apparatus where you just make a setting and you're not observing anything, right? You're not, but this will, of course, correlate to the other outcomes, but doesn't carry any outcome itself. So, if you want to ask a question, then you always need an element where you do have an outcome, because otherwise you cannot. So here, the only questions that are allowed, in some sense, relate to outcomes of measurements or observations.
So these could be purely quantum. I mean, they're not classical measuring devices.
Okay, maybe another thing I should have said. So my talk is titled Abstract Quantum Theory, but I'm cheating a bit, because in reality, almost everything I'll show you is not specific to quantum theory, okay? But I'll come to this later. So this is a framework which turns out to cover quantum theory and classical theory as well. And then later I'll tell you how to make this quantum or what. Okay. Let's see how far we get here. Okay, so the measurements. Okay, so yeah, so this gives you then actually a probability for a measurement when you do this kind of quotienting, okay? And another aspect of this I should emphasize is that these probes and boundary conditions, the spaces of them, don't necessarily have any natural normalization. So basically you can scale everything with positive real numbers, if you like. The only normalization that you have to take into account is a relative one, in this case, between those two probes. So you're not free to rescale these probes independently. And of course, that's clear, because otherwise you would destroy the partial order. Okay. Okay, so now, since we are talking about probabilities and we the predictions we make are generally probabilistic, we can, of course, make statements where we combine different experiments probabilistically. And so what we do here is that we implement this fact by allowing probes to be combined probabilistically, okay? So that means that, so you have a number of probes and probabilities that add to one, then we consider the weighted sum of these again as a probe. And yeah, I already mentioned this arbitrariness in the scale. That means that the space of probes in the end gets the structure of a real vector space, okay? Because, I mean, here we have addition, and then we have rescaling, and that gives us essentially a real... There's another aspect here which I haven't really explained, that there is a smaller space of probes that leads to probabilities and that are associated with compatibilities, as I told you. And there's a larger space of probes that are associated, for example, to measurements that don't give me probabilities, but, for example, expectation values. So those can be... So one space is what I call PM, and the other one PM plus. So these are the probes that give me compatibilities and give me probabilities. And this is a larger space of probes. And this is the one that forms a real vector space. This one then turns out to be a positive cone in this vector space. So that means that the structure I obtain on the space of probes is the structure of a partially ordered vector space. Okay, so this is absolutely central here. that this is the structure I get for the space of probes. And for the boundary condition, something similar happens. I can also, I can say, for example, that I know with 50% probability that the temperature is between 10 and 15 degrees, and with 50% probability is between 15 and 20. And I allow this composite statement, again, to be a boundary condition. Okay, so that means I allow the same kind of probabilistic combination of boundary conditions. And then I can take the space. Okay, so that means that these, I get a convex set. And I can take the vector space generated by this, and I call this the space of generalized boundary conditions. Okay, and then the what I called before boundary conditions with a plus here form a positive cone in this partially ordered vector space. And then I can extend the pairing between the space of probes and boundary conditions to the space of probes and generalized boundary conditions by linearity. Okay, and then this means that I get a bilinear form on this vector space, which moreover respects positivity in the sense that if I take a positive element here and here, I get a non-negative real number. So it's a positive pairing, positive bilinear form.
What is minus a probe?
Yeah, so minus, so here there's no minus a probe, here there is.
Yeah, so what does it mean?
So it means, so if you have a measuring device on the scale, instead of writing 1 to 5, you write minus 1 to minus 5. And that's, so you're here you're free to basically transform your results in a quite arbitrary manner. But here you're not. So here you don't have minus a probe.
So these combinations can have this piece of case to be negative.
No. I mean, okay, so here I was just talking about combining in a probabilistic way.
Yeah.
Okay, it's a bit complicated because there are different spaces that I'm talking about here. So this is something that I can do here, but here I can do more general combinations where I can have negative numbers. But then, of course, I don't. So if I have probabilities elements here, they give me probability. And if I combine them in this way, I still get probabilities. But if I take negative ones here, then I'm only in this larger space, and I'm getting some kind of expectation value, which is not a probability, of course, in general. Okay, another thing that I want to highlight is here. So talking about interfaces, so we postulate a special type of process which basically doesn't do anything on an interface. So sigma is an interface. It comes in and there's a second copy of sigma on the other side. So the type of interface associated with the process is two copies of the type sigma. And then if I take a process of this type and put the null probe there, then the meaning of this should be that it just passes signals through. It doesn't do anything. So it's diagrammatically equivalent to just having a single interface. Now, that means that since I have this pairing, I can take a boundary condition here and here. I combine the two in one, since I can combine two interfaces in one interface. Okay, I wrote here the tensor product because it turns out that due to the vector space structures we get, the map that I showed earlier will be multilinear. This map here will be multilinear. So I can write it as a linear map between the tensor product, and also it's extended to these generalized spaces of probes. Space of generalized boundary conditions. So I can form this quantity, and then value turns out to define me a bilinear form on the space of boundary conditions. Okay, so why is that? So first, it's clear we get a map like this, B sigma to R, right? That's clear from the structure here. Since these are the same types of probes, types of boundary conditions or types of interface, this is symmetric, really. And if I write BC or I interchange the two, doesn't matter, and I get the same result. So that's a symmetric form. And then with further arguments, you get, okay, so first you find that this should be non-degenerate, because otherwise you have boundary conditions that don't transmit any signals, okay? So you don't want that, so that makes it non-degenerate. And then with a further duality argument that I won't go into here, you find that this should really be positive definite, okay? So that means that in this way, you find that on the space of boundary conditions for each type of interface, you in fact have a positive definite inner product. And it turns out further that you can use that to show that this map, this composition of processes or of probes, more specifically here, can be that you can derive the value for a composite probe from the values of the individual probes. If you sum over a complete orthonormal basis of the space of boundary conditions associated with the interface between these two processes, okay. So here, yeah. So this is an orthonormal basis. Yes.
Sorry, I got a little confused about when you say boundary conditions. At some point, you were showing us thermometers. I had the impression
yes.
The boundary conditions were something like. Temperature or
could be,
or
yes.
Or
uh-huh.
Sort of,
yes.
But now I have the impression that they're like signals.
Yes, so
are
I.
Are they all lumped together?
Yes. So as I think I said it before, but maybe I didn't say it well, that so the boundary conditions have a dual role in both. I mean, they're associated with these interfaces, and they have the role on the one hand as specifying. For example, some ambient influence on some process, but at the same time, you can think of, I mean, they have the role of transmitting signals between processes. So, I mean, from the point of view of just one process, it's really the same thing. I mean, the process doesn't know if there's another process there, or we're just fixing the boundary condition on the interface. Okay, it's. It forms a positive cone in a real Hilbert space.
They are embedded
naturally
in some Hilbert space.
So if you want to call this a Hilbert space, since I have a positive definite inner product, so it's a real Hilbert space if you want.
The set of temperatures, for example, they're supposed to have a vector space structure and an inner product.
Well, not the same.
Different temperatures and so on.
Yeah. I mean, not necessarily a temperature itself, but maybe a range of a temperature range. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. But I mean, I have to do further work to get to this point. But you will see when we get there. Okay. So by the way, I mean this is a positive definite inner product space, but it's real. So this. Doesn't have anything to do directly with the quantum mechanical complex Hilbert space, okay? Nothing, okay? And as I said again, there's not, I'm not talking specifically about quantum theory yet, okay? Okay, basically all these things I was showing and the mathematical structure and the rules that you can use to extract from these structures probabilities or expectation values can be written down as an axiomatic framework. Okay, I didn't write the axioms here for you, but basically they are something like, okay, we have a bunch of types of interfaces, we have a bunch of types of processes. For each type of process, we have this partially ordered vector space of probes, and we can combine processes together. I mean, with this rule here, and yeah, the spaces of boundary conditions are partially ordered vector spaces that carry a positive definite inner product with certain properties, and so on. So this is kind of a list of axioms that you get out of this. Okay. And so basically, this axiomatic system is what you get. I call this the abstract positive formalism for reasons may become clear later. And so one thing I want to emphasize, so this is a framework that we get, which does not require a notion of space and time. So we haven't talked about space or time yet. Okay. On the other hand, it turns out that this framework is powerful enough to recover many other frameworks. So as I said already, this framework isn't yet specific to either quantum or classical theory. And in particular, so if we take this framework and we add further structure, I'll make this more precise, but not adding any further rules, then this can specializes, for example, to the convex operational framework. It specializes to the positive formalism in the space-time version. It specializes in a different direction to what the abstract quantum theory of the title. It specializes to quantum field theory as axiomatized in the sense of Siegel, which is what I mentioned briefly at the beginning. And also it specializes, sorry?
That's not quantum field theory,
No. It's called, what's called topological quantum field theory is a mathematical axiomatic system, which you may want to use to encode quantum field theory. The word topological is a kind of historical word that comes from the fact that the first theories mathematicians looked at were to use this framework were theories that correspond to only having topological degrees of freedom in space-time. But that doesn't mean that that you can only use it to encode topological field theories. It's a kind of misnomer. Yeah, so in particular, so the one that pushed this most since the end of the 80s is Graham Siegel. In particular, he most of his work is on conformal field theory in two dimensions. But it's an axiomatization of quantum field theory.
Is it in real time?
It's in real time. I mean, it's in space time, so there's no Vic rotation or anything like that. Yeah, and it's also called more recently functorial quantum field theory because, well, okay, let me not go into this. Later, if you want, I can tell you much more about this.
Yeah, like if we formulate a standard model, for example, in that language, is that
I hope so, yes.
No, I mean, not really. I mean, Siegel, the claim is that there already exists.
Well, I mean, what? I mean, he's obviously a mathematician, so he's doing this in a very rigorous fashion, and I mean, since we can't in any axiomatic framework, we haven't managed to construct an interacting quantum field theory in four dimensions. So, the hand waving, absolutely, yes. I mean, using the path integral that you like, for example, yeah, that's the most direct way to say.
Okay,
yeah.
Still later.
Yes.
I'm skeptical.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and also the standard formulation of quantum theory. On the other hand, you can also specialize this to classical physical theory, in particular classical statistical mechanics and statistical field theory. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I'm on the almost on the next slide. I will say more about this. Yeah. Okay. So yeah. Okay. So let me go to the next slide, and then much of this should become clearer. So the framework at this level. Okay. Just to make it completely clear. So we have an axiomatic framework, which is not a theory of physics. It's a framework for theory of physics, right? So it means if you want to specify a theory of physics, you have to specify what all these, I mean, what is your, what are the process types you have? What are the spaces of probes for each process type? What are the spaces of boundary conditions? You have to specify all of this to specify a theory, right? And this is just a framework. But I claim it's generally enough to, in particular, say, contain what is quantum theory on a maximally abstract level. Okay? It's basically what I already told you with one little more ingredient. Okay, so let me talk about that. Okay, so here we have what I call the abstract positive formalism, which is what I've tried to kind of derive for you from scratch. Okay. Now, one problem with this is that a priori, you have many processes, and any process a priori could be connected to any other one. Okay, so it's a very complex situation, and to make this simpler, you would like an ordering principle that tells you that you don't need to connect any process to any other one, but only certain processes to each other. And such a powerful principle is locality, space-time locality. Okay? And indeed, if you add space-time and locality, you get what I call the space-time positive formalism. So very roughly, the idea is that for each process, you have a space-time region. So the process lives in a space-time region. And the interfaces correspond to the hypersurfaces where I can glue the different regions together. Okay? And only if there's a hypersurface interfacing the two regions where the processes live, is there an interface. Otherwise, so between this process and this process, there isn't any interface, because a signal that I want to transmit from here to here has to pass through one of the other regions by locality. Okay, so I'm using locality as a very strong restriction on the interconnectivity of the processes that I would otherwise have. Okay, this is basically the explanation of. I mean, you can do the derivation that I started with directly in this context, and this is what my paper from October last year is mostly about. okay, but now you can specialize this further by adding time and causality. So why add time if I already have space-time? Well, adding time means that you distinguish between space and time. Okay. And then you can look at space-time regions that correspond to time intervals. And if you also add causality, probably not have time to explain how you do that, which basically implies that you have certain restrictions on the probes that are allowed, then what you get is exactly the convex operational framework that, I mean, many of you know and love. okay, so now all of this, I haven't really. Yeah.
You have a distinguished
time function? Yeah, so here I'm assuming I introduce a distinguished time function, and now exactly.
Can you say something about how this compares to the transform group pairs assess matrix formalism? at a very abstract level.
Yes, so in a sense, a process matrix is very much like a what I call a probe. So there's a very strong connection. It's more or less the same thing. Well, yeah, I think to explain this deeper, I would really have to tell you much more. So, but roughly speaking, that's, yeah. Or it's you, well, okay, depend on the, it could be the probe that corresponds to the exterior. Well, okay, let's leave it there. Okay, so one thing I said that this is all not specific to classical or quantum theory. So how do classical or quantum theory come into this picture? And so it turns out that there's a range of theories that you could put in there. And in particular, partially ordered vector spaces are not all alike, okay? I mean, if you have a finite dimensional vector space, then you just need the dimension to say, to identify uniquely up to isomorphism. With partially ordered vector spaces, it's quite different, and there are a whole range of these objects that you can have. In particular, you can have one extreme situation is that you have a lattice. And that basically means, okay, so a lattice means something about the partial order. It means that you have, if you have two elements, you always have a maximum and a minimum, something like that. But what it implies is that your partially ordered vector space is the space of functions on some set, okay, real-valued functions on some set. And so if the partially ordered vector spaces that are the spaces of boundary conditions, these B sigmas, if these are of that type, then this is basically classical theory. Okay. If, on the other hand, there's another extreme that is called anti-lattices, which corresponds to the situation that for two elements, you never have a maximum or minimum except if they're proportional to each other. Okay. And then that essentially specifies that your partially ordered vector space is the space of self-adjoint operators on a complex Hilbert space. Okay, so so the guy that came up with this idea, this notion of anti-lattice was Kadison at the beginning of the 50s, precisely to characterize in some pertinent way the space of self-adjoint operators on a complex Hilbert space. So this is where the Hilbert space of quantum theory comes in. Okay, it comes in indirectly through the structure of these partially ordered vector spaces that are the spaces of boundary conditions. Now, if you make the specialization and say, okay, moreover, my spaces of boundary conditions are lattices or are anti-lattices, then you're either in quantum theory or in classical theory. And on the level, on the space-time level, you have here this axiomatic approach of Siegel to quantum field theory that I mentioned, which is also related to my previous work that I call the general boundary formulation. There's also a classical analog of statistical field theory on manifolds with boundary that basically hasn't been explored really. And on the bottom level here, where you have the convex operational framework, you just get here the standard formulation of quantum theory. And here you get statistical mechanics, basically, in the usual sense. Okay, so I have some more slides that basically explain these arrows a bit more, but probably not have much time to show them. Maybe, I don't know, maybe I can just go very fast and see if I can tell you something more about this. Okay, so yeah, so the adding space-time and locality, as I said, means that you put the processes in space-time regions, and then you can forget about these lines that we were drawing, and then you just have regions in hypersurface. So the regions being process types, and the hypersurfaces being interface types. Now you can specialize further to the situation where your space-time is R times sigma, where R is time and sigma is some spatial manifold. And then you can look at the specific space-time regions that correspond to time intervals. And then, a time interval has two boundaries, an initial and a final one. And so for each of these, you have an interface. So you have a space of boundary conditions, and this, let's call this now the state space, okay? In fact, this recovers exactly the notion of state space at time t. Now you have a probe in this region, and this pairing of the probe with the product of the boundary conditions, you can rewrite this as the inner product, which you have in the space of boundary conditions of the initial probe evaluated on some map and paired with the final boundary condition. And this defines your map between the initial and the final, you can now call state space, okay? And you can also write this more explicitly in this way, and then it turns out that these probe maps, that these probe maps have a strong property that I call boundary positivity, which in classical theory just turns out to be equivalent to positivity, and in quantum theory it turns out to be equivalent to complete positivity. Okay, so here we get the complete positivity of quantum operations. So then the null probe corresponds to a free time evolution, and you can compose them. I told you that the boundary conditions form a hierarchy of generality, and now we add the assumption that there exists a special state, that now we can call it state, a special boundary condition, that is maximally general, and that we can call a state of maximal uncertainty, which encodes a complete net lack of knowledge about our interface, if you want, or system, as you would like to say then. And then you can, what does it mean? I remember this partial order. So mathematically, what I want is that this element is larger or equal than any other element, essentially, right? Because that meant that it's more general than any other element. Okay, it's the maximally general element. But since I have this, in general, this rescaling freedom, I cannot require that it's larger or equal than any boundary condition, but I can require that it is so when I rescale it in some way. Okay. Now, this turns out to be exactly the mathematical definition of the notion of order unit in a partially ordered vector space. So this is an order unit. Okay, now what can I do with this? In fact, it's used mostly as a final state. And it's precisely what you use when you say that you make a measurement and you don't care what happens with your system after the measurement. Okay. This corresponds exactly to putting the final state to be this state of maximal uncertainty E. So in a setup here, so if we want to talk about the probability for an affirmative outcome of some given experiment, given some initial state, but disregarding the final state, we just put in the expression that corresponds to the probability, which is this one here, the final state to be this E, okay? This special state of maximal uncertainty. And then I can also write this in terms of the probe maps in this way. And more conventionally, you would say that you're doing a measurement without post-selection. So basically, if this is not E, then you might say, you would usually call this a measurement with post-selection. And then you can use the E to normalize states if you want. And in particular, you can use it to normalize probe maps, so these evolution maps in some sense. So you can say it's normalization preserving if it preserves the inner product with this E, or decreasing if it decreases this. And it's precisely this what is conventionally used to introduce a notion of causality. The no, standard notion of causality in quantum theory works precisely this way. You require that non-selective quantum operations, okay, here probe maps, preserve the normalization, and that selective probe maps decrease the normalization. Okay. And this turns out to implement causality, and you can check that really then the outcome of this experiment doesn't depend on whatever experiment you perform later. And well, this, of course, a time asymmetric condition. And so finally, to come back to the specialization to classical and quantum theory, so in this setting with this now time evolution states and causality and so on, if we take this space of states now to be a lattice, then we can identify the set on which these are functions with a phase space. So then that is the phase space of the classical theory that we can get, that we get. And what we get is the classical statistical mechanics. And so this the special state E is just the constant function of value 1. And the inner product then turns out to be the L2 inner product. Okay. So on the space of statistical distribution. So this is then a space of statistical distributions. Okay, and then, okay. And on the other hand, if we take this to be an anti-lattice, then this means that it's the space of self-adjoint operators on some complex Hilbert space, and we obtain quantum statistical mechanics, where it turns out that this E will now be the identity operator, and the inner product is the trace, is the Hilbert-Schmidt Hilbert-Schmidt inner product, so you take the product of the operators and the trace. And the primitive probe maps are then exactly the quantum operations if they're normalized. Thanks.
Do you have any prospects on fundamental quantum theory of gravity?
Okay, so one motivation comes from quantum gravity because, I mean, one of the problems we have when we want to formulate a quantum theory of gravity is that if you use the standard formulation of quantum theory, then you need a notion of time already. And so the idea is that this more general formulation, since it doesn't use a notion of time, could get around this problem and be a more appropriate context to formulate a quantum theory of gravity.
Can you review again what anti-lattice was and how it gives you a complex Hilbert space?
Yeah, okay. In fact, this is a question that's not mathematically settled completely. So, So an anti-lattice, okay, so if you have a partially ordered set, then an anti-lattice is so you take two elements, and you take all the elements that are larger or equal than both of them, and so you ask if the set of elements you get has a minimum or not. Okay, if it has a minimum, then this is the thing that you call the maximum of those two elements. And symmetrically. So now a lattice is if you take any two elements, you get these, a minimum and maximum. And anti-lattice is that if you take two elements and you get a maximum and or minimum, then they are proportional to each other. So if they are proportional to each other, then automatically one of them is the maximum and the other is the minimum. That's.
But you mean the two elements, you mean you have. You have a maximum and a median adjoint,
as
they call it. You have
that if and only if the two elements are proportional. Yes. That's the definition of anti. It's not necessarily a vector space,
what is
but
proportional?
You're right. It's in the vector space. Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, one of the two conditions is sufficient because it implies the other. Partially ordered vector space. Yeah.
So anti-lattice means you never have a meet or a join.
Exactly. Except
in the trivial.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And so, okay. So it's not as far as I understand, it's not quite settled what kind of spaces have these properties have, but it's so okay. So it's at least slightly more general than spaces of self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space. It could also be von Neumann factors, which are slightly more general. They are also anti-lattices. So if I say okay, anti-lattice is quantum theory, I'm a bit sloppy because I mean there are these unsettled questions.
And the only other thing is von Neumann factors. That's what you get in quantum field theory.
Anyway. Yeah, right. I mean, if you think about algebraic quantum field theory, then anyway, you would be happy with that. So it's unclear if you can get something further or not.
There's a theorem that a vector space is an anti-lattice. It has to be.
Yeah, exactly. This theorem doesn't exist yet.
So leave out these other cases. Then it has to be the set of all self-adjoint operators in a complex Hilbert space. Is that the statement?
Yeah, I mean this theorem doesn't exist. Okay, it's
even if I have the
I don't know. I mean, I'm usually interested in the infinite dimension case only, but
it can't be a real. It doesn't work if it's a real.
I think no, it cannot be a real Hilbert space. No. By the way, I mean, since you talk about real Hilbert spaces, the possibility that that we take a space of boundary conditions or states, the space of operators on a real Hilbert space is excluded by other aspects of what I told you. But, okay, I don't want to go into this.
This is a very general comment about quantum gravity. I mean, you've got a system in the whole framework of operational where you have measurements taking place. So how, coming back to the question that I asked earlier, which was that are there these generalized measurements which are not actually explicitly an external measurement taking place? Because in the context of quantum cosmology, there's no such thing. So I'm curious what you mean by the framework being relevant to quantum gravity, unless it's something I'm missing.
Okay, if you want more about this. Okay, so you can imagine, for example, formulating quantum gravity in this framework. Okay, so this is where I've added space-time. But when I say space-time, this is here just a notion that might be topological, or we could talk about differentiable manifolds, but they don't need to have a predefined metric. Okay, so at this stage, so the point is that it turns out that in this framework, modulo the question if the Siegel axiomatization program is ultimately successful or not, but supposing it's ultimately successful, you could presumably encode the standard model in this way, for example. Of course, in the standard model you would have a metric structure that you put in by hand, right? But now it's not a big stretch to say, okay, now I want to use this to quantize theories where I don't have a fixed metric, and that this should still work. Okay, so or a fixed differentiable structure, something like that. Yeah. 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 Okay. In fact. Yeah, this convergence from that I talked about at the beginning is not so evident in the way I'm presenting things here. You can also go a completely different way, and you can start with quantum field theory and this axiomatization and not talk about observables or anything like that at the beginning, and you can kind of build this up and then add at the end these probes. So it turns out that in this context, there's a lot of information, even without talking about probes, or only talking about what I call the null probe. So here, the null probe is not something completely trivial. What the null probe is basically you have a space-time region, and you don't put any apparatus in there. But anyway, there's a physical dynamics in the space-time region that is encoded in the null probe. So this is there whether you do any measurement or not. And then, for example, for example, you can express the S matrix in such a way. And in fact, in this, I've done a lot of work in particular on quantum field theory in such a context. I mean, there are no probes yet, but on this level without probes, say. And for example, you can use this to generalize the S matrix. You can take boundary conditions. Let's say you're in Minkowski space. Instead of at temporal infinity, you can take boundary conditions at spatial infinity. Okay. So instead of doing an S matrix between initial time and a final time, you do an S matrix on a hypercylinder at a finite radius and send the radius to infinity. And this becomes more interesting when you go to spacetimes that don't admit asymptotic initial and final state like ADS. So you can define an S matrix on ADS with that. So I've worked on that with a student recently, for example. But this also all fits together with what I was telling you today. It's not so obvious, perhaps, how this fits together, but in a very natural way. And this, in fact, really a generalization of the other thing. Right.
Let's say we apply this in space-time to the quantum field theory, or maybe ultimately gravity. You have a blue region, a yellow region, a brown region. Are we to take those seriously? In other words, not the colors, but
the regions.
Are we?
No, no,
or something like
no.
Or are these boundaries fictitious?
Yes, exactly.
But how can they be fictitious? Your whole framework depends on having. Are we taking some continuum limit in which the regions go to zero?
No. It's.
Or are they? Is the choice of regions a pure gauge thing? We can divide the space time up in any way we like.
Yes, basically.
Are all equivalents.
No,
what's
I mean, it depends on
different. No. You know, different tilings of the space.
I mean, the bound from this point of view, the regions and boundaries are.
He says he doesn't want to take it.
No, I mean, there's no continuum. Yeah, so the regions and the boundaries, they don't have a direct physical meaning. They are the use that we use them to is to. So if we put an apparatus here. Okay, what we do is we say, okay, my experiment lasts from that hour to that hour, and it's confined to this laboratory. That defines me a space-time region. Okay, and this space-time region I will use to describe my experiment. And the experiment could.
I mean, when you go to the LHC, you don't find.
No, you have exactly that.
You don't look in the tunnel and find a bunch of small laboratories.
No, you have your detector. That's a space. Yeah, and what you do is, in fact, the particles that come in and go out of your detector, you encode them in the boundary conditions here, which you always do in quantum field theory. I mean, an initial state is a state of n particles. Okay, it's exactly the same here, except you're more free. You can do this on a time-like hypersurface.
Maybe you want to revive bootstrap idea or something like
no.
That. No. Some S matrix approach to everything. I thought you said you, at least according to this program by Graham Siegel, that you can encode ordinary quantum field theory.
Yes.
In this language. So
yes.
Then we don't have, space-time is not filled with small laboratories. So I ask again, what's the significance of these
these interfaces, this yellow, blue, and brown region. So even if you put a null,
So
in there, what defines the boundary of that region?
The boundary is arbitrary. It's a local an axiomatization. So forget about the probes. Put the null probe everywhere. Okay. So this is then it's an axiomatization. And in fact.
Okay, but then suppose I read if the boundaries are arbitrary, suppose like there's a different set of boundaries. In what sense is it the same theory as the first one? With the first set of boundaries.
That in the sense of the axioms that tell you if you glue two regions together, then the composite region, the null probe for the composite region is I mean, in particular, what's central here is this formula. Okay, so that means these probes, if they are null probes, they are generalizations of transition amplitudes. Okay, so these are. If you want transition amplitudes, space-time generalized, and what these things tells you is the amplitude for a space-time region, and this tells you that if you glue these regions together, the amplitude for the composite region is this.
So then I think you have another axiom, or maybe several more axioms.
Which
something that would give the independence of decomposition of the space-time into regions. I could make two overlapping decompositions. Neither one would be greater or less than the other in the sense of your partial order. I could then take sort of their mutual and their common refinement or something like that. That would be a third.
For example,
set
yeah.
And
then I can check that they are the same.
That there always is some sort of common refinement. I mean, I just think there's something else beyond what you showed us. Want to get quantum field theory. It's not.
Well,
you basically just showed us was a graph or something.
Yeah, no, of course.
And
the way.
You really need the whole ensemble of graphs with some relation.
Yeah, I mean, I was starting with the graphs in order to show you the formulation without space time. Of course, if you do quantum field theory, what you want, you don't want to work here, you want to work here. That's what I was. And here, each process type is a space-time region. Each interface type is a hypersurface. And that's.
Right,
and
but if I subdivide space to make it a cell complex, or if I triangulate it, say, a simplicial complex, then I'll get a particular graph.
Yes.
But now if I triangulate it another way, I'll get a different graph. What I'm asking about is how those two graphs
how they relate.
Can be regarded as the same, describing the same physics.
Yeah.
It seems to me you need another axiom.
So it turns out that this thing here, so basically, to formulate your question in a different way, I think what you're asking for is if you have a sequence of decompositions, what you want is then if you have two different sequences and your total region is the same, that the amplitude, in quantum field theoretic language, is the same.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that's.
Do you have a partial order possible decomposition? And so the question is, how do those.
Yes, so,
to each other?
Okay.
So this will be the last comment
yeah.
on yourself.
Okay. Yes, so that relates to here. Okay, I would have to draw a picture with more than two probes. I mean, to like compose first those two and then the other third and then in another order. And this all has to give the same result. That's what you're worried about. So.
I won't.
Okay, so in a sense, this is part of the axiom here. I mean, okay, so one. I didn't really list for you the axioms in a mathematically precise way. I could do that, but I didn't want to do it to not scare you. But from then, this associativity condition, if you want to call it like, is there. Okay.
I think more
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks.